This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The overbooking backlash. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. And here's what we've got for you this hour. United Airlines had the right to remove that overbooked passenger, but should it have? Kids of military personnel face numerous challenges. We'll take a look at what they are and how they can get help in this National Month of the Military Child. There's a new, softer, warmer way to stage a friend or family intervention. And just how many St. Mary's colleges are there?
You know, there's two Augustanas and three Westminsters and two Georgetowns, and you kind of just have to make sure you know which one you're looking at, if it's a website or something like that.
Melissa Korn of the Wall Street Journal will be here later in the hour to talk about the confusion created by colleges that all have the same name. Well, it was one of the stories this week that took the country by storm. United Airlines' decision to use security personnel to drag a 69-year-old doctor off an overbooked flight from Chicago to Louisville. The incident has many of us wondering why it happened, what United could have done differently, and what we'd do if it happened to us. Here to help sort it all out is Ben Mutzebaugh of USA Today. Ben, why did United wait until everyone was on that plane before realizing it needed seats for its own employees?
Really a question that a lot of people in the industry are asking right now. And we've not got an answer on that, but I think it's clear to say that something didn't go as planned for that, because that is not the way that's supposed to work. An involuntarily denied boarding, which is technically what a situation like this is called, or bumping as it's more frequently known, is never a good thing, but it's certainly a lot worse when the passengers that you're hoping to bump are already on the plane. It's a lot easier to tell them when they're at the gate, sorry, the flight is full and we had to select you at random to not get on the plane. So something didn't quite go the way it should have there, and I don't think that we've seen any answers for that yet, but that's probably something a lot of people will continue to be curious about until we know more.
Ben, how do airlines decide who gets bumped?
It really varies by carrier, and in many cases it varies on a case-by-case basis even. They will sometimes use things like the last check-in or the lowest fare or the people with the lowest frequent flyer status. So there's really kind of a sliding scale, but at the end of the day is it's kind of, there's no fast and loose rule for this. It's kind of on a case-by-case basis, and there are priorities given to certain passengers. Some will be obvious, minors traveling alone or children traveling with families. And then airlines will typically ask if they've found a passenger either at random or through whatever their process is, if they are traveling for an emergency. So there is some kind of vetting process that typically happens. I think it's worth repeating here in the case of this United situation, the flight was actually operated by one of their regional affiliates, that this is not a by-the-book example of booking. This is pretty much every way that overbooking can go wrong.
We're speaking with Ben Mutzebaugh from USA Today. Ben, what rights do we as flyers have if someone comes up and says, we need your seat?
That's a question we've been hearing a lot about, and it may surprise a lot of people to hear that there actually aren't many rights that you have in this situation. The airlines are entitled to remove passengers, or typically to keep passengers from getting on the flight, if the flight is oversold. The government does not prevent that. It's a common practice throughout the industry. The airlines defend the practice, saying that they do oversell these flights because they know in any given flight there'll be a certain number of no-shows. So this allows them to try to sell every seat while also accounting for the no-shows. And they argue, in turn, this helps keep fares low. And in fairness to the airlines, involuntarily denied boarding is very rare, but it does happen. So when it does happen, you don't have a right to that seat that you may feel entitled to because you've paid for it, but what the government does say is that you are entitled to compensation, and it varies depending on the length of the delay, when the airline gets you to your final destination, and it caps out for at 400% of the value of your one-way ticket although that is capped at about $1,300 per passenger. So it's actually a significant payout for most domestic flights if you ever are involuntarily denied boarding, but it may not be worth it to you, and it's certainly what we're seeing for this United situation. Boy, that's just, it's worth repeating, that did not go by the books.
Ben, after this public outcry and firestorm, do you think there may be some kind of change to airlines' policy on overbooking?
Well, you can bet right now that every airline manager in the country, at every airline, is talking about this and either has already started or is getting ready to talk to their employees everywhere from management to the front line to say, this didn't go well, and here's how we can avoid a situation like this at our carrier. So you can be sure this is a conversation that's happening at airports and airlines across the country. Now, whether it will precipitate a change in procedure, that remains to be seen. Technically, United did things by the book. Now, that said, there was so much that went wrong with this.
Thanks, Ben. Ben Mutzebaugh of USA Today. Coming up, why military families need some extra support.
The powerful performance and incredible battery life of new Dell PCs with Intel Core processors empower small business employees to do their best work wherever work takes them. Dell's U.S.-based small business advisors and price match guarantee mean you'll always get the best deal on the right solution tailored to your business needs. Powerful PCs are just the beginning of a great partnership. Call 877-BUY-DELL now to contact a Dell small business advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Gordon Deal off, Jennifer Koshinka sitting in on this weekend. It's hard enough to raise kids. It's way harder when you're in a military family. Retired Army Major Jeff Hall and his wife, Sherry, join us now to talk about the unique problems that face military families and how best to support them. Sherry, let's start with you. What are some of the issues that military kids face?
Well, I think one of the things is only having one parent at home. And that, for our girls, that seemed to be the hardest part, was dad being gone, especially missing holidays, birthdays, special occasions. They always wished that dad would be there for that basketball game or softball game. So I just think that's the separation from one parent, even though you have one loving parent at home, can be really difficult for them at times.
Did you move a lot? And is that another issue that military kids have to face, getting used to new settings, new schools?
We moved about every 3.5 years. And our girls are very close in age. And while it was harder for them the older they got, like into high school and things, I think they adjusted pretty well. They were used to it. So it was just like, okay, it's time to move again. It became exciting, a new place, new friends, a new school. So it was just a way also, you know, they could reinvent themselves if they needed to. But they really adjusted pretty well. They've always been each other's best friends. So they always had a friend when they got to a new place.
Jeff, you served two tours of duty in Iraq and had some tough times when you returned. Can you tell us about how your experiences impacted your family?
My experiences in Iraq, I tried to keep to myself, and that almost consumed my family. I think that just going 100 mile an hour every day for years at a time and then coming back to the peace, it wasn't easy to stop. And it affected my family in ways that I expected them to react, not just be, you know, kids. When I told them to get in the car, I meant right now. And, you know, it makes it very difficult for young kids to be commanded instead of led like a father generally would.
I would imagine your experiences in that area were not unique, that many of the people in the military that you served with face similar problems when they return.
Yeah, I have lots of guys that was under my command. I've known people, and it's just a very hard thing to do to just switch over. Flying home from a combat zone and being home in 48 hours after the last action you were in, it can be a very difficult time just throwing the brakes on, number one. But then you don't have the excitement. You don't have the thing that you've been doing. And being back in the United States, just it wasn't fun for me. And then it's just, you know, I put that over onto my family. And I didn't even know it was happening until I actually went and got help.
You got help. What kinds of resources did you use? And how were you able to smooth out some of the problems in the family?
Well, at the time, there wasn't a whole lot of help available. This was early 2008 when it happened to me, and I went to behavioral health, and I immediately walked out of there. I couldn't handle that until my commander got involved. Actually, Sherry called my commander and said, "Hey, Jeff is acting this way." My commander said, "Yeah, I've seen it at work," and it was a lot of anger. I was sent out to Walter Reed, where I got some very professional help. And again, they just kind of put the mirror up in front of me, and I got to see who I was, which was shocking, actually. And they gave me some tools to cope with it. And over the years, a lot of my symptoms kind of subsided. But yeah, it doesn't go away, but you learn how to deal with it.
Sherry, why is it so important to ask for help?
For us, we didn't want to let Jeff go, and he was suicidal at the time. So I had some fear that, you know, if I left him alone too long, I might come home to a disaster. And we wanted our family back together. He was pushing us away, and I wouldn't let him do that. So sure, I was a nuisance at times, but I felt like we needed to fix this as best we could, get through it, and figure out a way to cope, like he said. And so, you know, I just stood in there as strong as I could, and I wanted our family to be whole again. So it was very important for me to find the right help for him.
You're both involved with the Real Warriors campaign. What is that all about?
They have a really great website. They approached us about a year after we went through treatment at Walter Reed and asked us if we would tell our story. And it's on their website, realwarriors.net. And, you know, they have much more information and resources on there for service members, family members, retirees, garden reservists, just different articles that you can read about things that may be going on in other people's lives, chat rooms if you feel like you want to just sit down and chat with another family member or service member. They also have a lot of things geared towards children, Sesame Street Workshop, and then they do promote Military Month of the Child, which is April. So it's just really important that you get out there and reach out through their website at realwarriors.net, where you can find all kinds of help.
That's Jeff and Sherry Hall of Oklahoma talking about April as National Month of the Military Child. It's 21 minutes after the hour. Coming up, television's anniversary frenzy. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Brace yourself for the anniversary frenzy. After the success of two television shows last year on O.J. Simpson, the networks are going crazy, making documentaries to mark a bunch of anniversaries, ranging from the 1992 Los Angeles riots to the death of Princess Diana. John Jurgensen of the Wall Street Journal joins us now to talk about this wave of documentaries. John, why is everyone jumping on the bandwagon?
I think it's really a way to stand out from the crowd. Well, maybe ironic because now the whole crowd is doing these anniversary documentaries, but there's been a real interest in finding these moments of reflection, I guess, on the past that help people kind of process these things that have happened before, that have come before us, these big kind of cultural milestones. I think people don't necessarily realize they're hoping, you know, looking for those kind of documentaries until they arrive. I mean, I think the O.J. Simpson series of last year really helped kind of set off this trend. I think for a lot of people, the O.J. Simpson trial was, you know, ancient history and something that people were only too happy to put behind them. But then suddenly when they were put in a new context of a dramatization and a multi-part documentary series, people realized that there was a lot more significance there than they may have thought. So a lot of these TV networks and TV producers are looking for ways to re-examine history through that lens. And they're finding that these big events that a lot of us live through are great ways to do it because it's not new. It's a sort of a memory lane exercise that lets us reprocess these things in a new way.
It's reprocessed, but are they finding new information we didn't know about?
In some cases, I think so. I mean, that's the goal, is that a lot of these people want to go back and find new footage, new voices, or maybe voices that got obscured in the big rush that people had either forgotten about or ignored at the time. So for example, Smithsonian Channel has this Lost Tapes series where they purport to unearth footage and kind of primary source material that was used at the time, and they're using this for the LA riots anniversary that's coming up to kind of show what was happening on the ground at this time. So I don't know if it's necessarily always going to be brand new stuff, but maybe it's a new way of framing these incidents that we didn't have the ability to do at the time. When it's breaking news, it's all kind of coming at you fast, and then 25 years later, people find the opportunity to go back and say, all right, what did it all mean?
We're speaking with John Jurgensen of the Wall Street Journal. John, are they all documentaries? Are they movies based on real events, or a little of both?
A little bit of both, but I think the real big push are the sort of feature-length documentaries, two-hour movies, or in some case, multi-part movies that reinvestigate this stuff. I don't know if we necessarily always need a multi-part thing. I mean, some of the executives I've talked to have complained a little bit that, you know, these producers are coming in and pitching these, you know, a six-part miniseries on the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And, you know, just because it worked for OJ doesn't mean it's going to work for Princess Diana, Monica Lewinsky, or any of these sort of big moments of the 90s. People like the idea of a grand scale documentary, but in practice, not all of us always have the stomach for that.
Are they moneymakers?
I think that what's happening is that it's harder and harder to break through with new content. I mean, as we all know, that you know, TV is just completely swamped with new shows, new series. They're always trying to sort of break out with introducing new shows, and whether or not they can do this, but the hope is that they'll succeed by reintroducing something that we're familiar with from the past. You know, it's the same kind of reason we're seeing all these reboots of old TV shows. You know, if we can get people interested in something that they already know, or at least think that they already know, then that's like half the battle, right? So it's the same kind of principle that applies to these documentaries as applies to the fictional reboots that are so popular on TV right now. And the track record is certainly mixed. I mean, CBS did a JonBenet Ramsey miniseries recently for the 20th anniversary of her death. And, you know, they did pretty well with that, and some of those cable channels did the same thing as well. It wasn't a breakout success, but anything that moves the needle in terms of ratings these days is something that people are going to pay attention to.
Thanks, John. John Jurgensen of the Wall Street Journal. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal, and here are some of the stories we're following for you this weekend. Experts say there's a better way to do a group intervention for someone who's struggling with a specific problem. You're certainly hoping for a tax refund this year, but there are a bunch of things that may trip you up and actually cause you to owe Uncle Sam. And if you say you want to attend St. Mary's, you're going to have to be more specific. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, when it comes to an intervention, there's a new softer thinking these days. Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal has written an article called A New Way to Stage a Group Intervention and joins us now. Elizabeth, when I think of an intervention, I always think of a drug problem. What other things are leading to interventions these days?
That's definitely the classic one, drug or alcoholism, you know, and so your family's all in a room, your friends are going to broadside you with, you know, the fact that they want you to change. And that helped a lot of people, but it was also traumatizing. And so now these interventions, which as we'll talk about, are softer, kinder, they can be used for anything. And I found this interesting. So people use them if they see somebody maybe not being healthy, not following doctor's orders, eating too much, not having a decent, you know, healthy lifestyle. Maybe somebody's depressed and really checked out. You might want to wrap some support around them. Smoking, maybe making bad choices in relationships. I mean, really bad choices. Someone who's harmful, that kind of thing.
When do you know it's time to stage an intervention?
Many people worry about it and think, I'm going to, you know, I'm worried about my loved one. And we all talk about it behind their back. Everybody's worried. We don't know what to do. People don't stage interventions because they feel like they don't know if they should, and also they feel like maybe they're ill-equipped, they're not ready, they don't know how to do it. And that's usually wrong. You want to, if you're worried about somebody, what's the harm in telling them and trying to help them? You're not bullying them. You want to make sure, though, that this is coming from a place of, I want to help this person, they're struggling, and not a place of bullying or of just disapproval. I don't care for their choices, so I'm going to let them know. That's not time for an intervention.
Elizabeth, how do you get started, and what makes it softer these days?
So what makes it softer is instead of that broadside, you're going to invite the person over on false pretenses and then suddenly 15 people are in the room to tell them what they're doing wrong. You're going to reach out to them, hopefully in person, and tell them you're worried and then invite them to their own intervention. You know, so you say, hey, you know, we're the family's worried about you. You know, you're really checked out. You seem like you're really struggling. You know, we'd like to help you. We're having a meeting about this tomorrow. We'd like you to come. We're having this meeting anyway, so we really hope you'll come, and we can all talk about it and see how to help you. That's what's kinder about it, and that's how you start.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal about interventions, whether it's with family or friends. Once you get that person there, how do you approach it?
Well, one thing to do, which also leads to the sort of kinder, gentler part, is, you know, the experts say create a warm atmosphere. So you want to have this at home. Maybe have food, have some calming music. You create more of like a family kind of meeting, gathering element to it. And then you want to start by being very positive. You want to tell the person you love them and, you know, also, you know, what you admire about them. You see them being strong in the face of whatever adversity they're facing, and you know they mean well, you know that they are, you know, doing their best, but you think they could use a little help, and you know you're here to help, and you have some ideas, you want to bring ideas to the table, and sometimes just, you know, look, you know, Dad, you know, we see you not eating right. You know, we see you not listening to your doctor. You got to lose 100 pounds right now. It's not going to work, right? So you want to have small step ideas. You want to have a stepped approach. Here's some things we can do to start out, and then we're going to move on, but we're going to be with you every step of the way.
Now, Elizabeth, obviously, in researching your story, you talked to some people who have gone through the process. Did it work?
It does work. I mean, change is hard for anybody, even if you want to change. Say, you know, I want to lose 10 pounds. It's hard. So you can't expect that change from a person who's already struggling with their issue right away. But it does really work. And what's nice about this is we don't really anticipate how much someone who is struggling alone and doesn't maybe feel the support or know they have the support that they might have. So rather than talking about your worry for somebody, reaching out to them is really important and staying with it. It does definitely help. And I talked to people who had interventions. They were invited to their own interventions for everything from depression to a teenage boy who was 17 who was anorexic. So, you know, they're just across the board helpful.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal talking to us about new interventions. It's 21 minutes before the hour. Coming up, reasons you could end up with a surprise tax bill this year. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal on this weekend. Despite dreading tax time, most of us will end up with a refund, but some of us will end up with an unexpected bill. Janelle Marte of the Washington Post has the story. Janelle, how can you end up owing money when you didn't think you would?
So there may be something big that changed in your life, and it may not be obviously connected to taxes, but probably you sat down to do your tax return and got the unpleasant surprise of this bill. And, you know, one common situation where this might happen is if you took on a side job, right? So let's say you started driving for Uber or you're delivering food through Postmates and you're just thinking, great, I'm going to make some extra cash. Well, you probably are not having income taxes withheld from that paycheck, which means that you have to pay the taxes, by the April deadline. And so for some people, if they're not having enough money taken out of their, like, 9-to-5 job, if they still have one, that could lead to a tax bill.
How do you change that for next year? Maybe you get penalized this year, but can you do something about it so it doesn't happen again?
Let's say if you do have another day job, you want to adjust your withholdings, maybe have a little bit more money taken out of your paychecks throughout the year. That way it increases the chances that you'll have paid enough by the April deadline. Or if you are now freelancing most of the time, you may need to start making estimated tax payments, and that's due once a quarter.
We're speaking with Janelle Marte of the Washington Post. Let's talk about getting married and or filing for divorce. How does that impact taxes?
You're thinking about your lifelong commitment here, but depending on the income, of each spouse, and if they're the same or similar, you could end up with what's called a marriage penalty or a marriage bonus. So to oversimplify it a bit, when you have two people who get married and they make around the same amount of income, the chances are higher that they're going to end up in a higher tax bracket as a married couple. And that could essentially lead to a bigger tax bill. And for, you know, it's something definitely to consider. It may not be the make or break component of the relationship, but for some people it can be a surprise. Another thing to keep in mind is that when you get divorced, you may have to give up some of the deductions that you were claiming as a married couple. For example, anything related to children, typically only one parent will be able to claim those child-related tax breaks. Sometimes if there are tax breaks regarding property, or you might now end up in a different tax bracket on your own than when you were married. So there's just a lot of things changing, a lot of moving parts, and it could lead to a tax bill.
Janelle, what about tapping your 401k? People don't want to do it, but sometimes they have to.
Sometimes you have to, and you know the issue here is that you probably know you owe taxes on that money, but one thing that can be a little bit confusing is that they will automatically withhold about 20% from the withdrawal before they pay it out to you, but that might not be enough to cover everything that you owe, depending on what tax bracket you're in, and also depending on if you owe the penalty, because you may be able to have that 10% penalty tax waived if you are going through some sort of hardship and you meet one of the exemptions. But if you don't, then you may owe the 10% on top of that. And it, you know, just keep in mind that just because they took some money out of the check before they gave it to you, you may still owe money at the end of the year.
That's Janelle Marte of The Washington Post. It's 14 minutes before the hour coming up. The confusion caused by colleges with the same name.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to Barracuda.com/ransomware to learn more.
Gordon Deal taking some time off. Jennifer Kashinka in for this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. St. Mary's in San Antonio or St. Mary in Leavenworth, Kansas or St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, Maryland. It was confusing during NCAA tournament time, and it's confusing to many people when colleges and universities all have the same name. Melissa Korn of the Wall Street Journal says you need to be specific. Melissa, how do we move past the confusion?
I don't know if we can. Part of it is a branding thing by schools to really try to differentiate, tie your name to a location. So there's St. Mary's University of Minnesota, which is a little harder to be confused with St. Mary's of California, St. Mary's College of California. But if you're just, you know, there's two Augustanas and three Westminsters and two Georgetowns, and you kind of just have to make sure you know which one you're looking at, if it's a website or something like that. And even people really close to the school get confused.
How do these mix-up affect things like admissions?
They absolutely affect admissions. Admissions officers at schools tell all the time of people who sent in their deposits to the wrong school, call the wrong school's admissions office to get an update on an application when they actually had applied to the other one. They send test scores to the wrong schools. I even spoke to one student who sent his, he planned to apply to Cornell University, sent his test scores to Cornell College in Iowa, figured out the mistake, and ended up reading up on the other school, and he's now a tour guide at Cornell College. So sometimes it works out okay, but it can definitely be a little embarrassing.
What about donations? Does it affect donations to schools as well?
Absolutely, and I had some confusions about Seton Hall and Seton Hill and a couple of different Holy Crosses. So people do make donations. Even people who attended the schools send money to the wrong one. But my understanding from the donations, the administrators, is that they do pass the money along to the right destination. So at least they're good-hearted about that.
We're speaking with Melissa Korn of the Wall Street Journal. Does the confusion between schools sometimes cause them to fight?
It does. There are a bunch of legal battles in court records about
this sort of thing. And it's often not the unintentional, oh, this is funny, we've had the same name for 100 years, and now we're going to start fighting about it. It's often a school changes its name to sound a lot like another institution, and then somebody sues, or a school kind of encroaches on someone's territory. So they didn't have a presence in that state before, and now they do, and now there's confusion. It's often involved with for-profit colleges that sound a lot very similar to older nonprofit schools.
On the flip side of that, does some school sometimes say, you know, we've had it, I don't want to be the 15th St. Mary's, we should consider changing our name to St. Paul?
And then they'd run into probably a few other St. Paul's.
True.
There are schools that change their names to stand out a little bit more. There were two Our Lady of the Lakes, one college, one university, and one of them has recently announced it's going to change its name for a few reasons, but in part because it had been a college and now could be a university, and it didn't want to be the second Our Lady of the Lakes University. So hopefully it'll differentiate itself a little bit more now that it has a new name.
Thanks, Melissa. Melissa Korn of the Wall Street Journal. It's 7 minutes before the hour coming up. How to recruit a young baseball fan. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal this weekend. By the way, if you like small business or startup stories, check out the Small Business Report, done twice weekly and available on our website this morning with GordonDeal.com or on places like iTunes and SoundCloud. Why are you a fan of the baseball team that you're a fan of? Probably because you're carrying on a family tradition, or maybe it's simply a matter of location and convenience. But that won't be the case for Pete Van Vliet's young son, Jake. Yahoo Sports says the longtime Houston Astros fan wants his son to make his own decision. And in doing so, he's challenged all 30 Major League Baseball teams to fight for his son's fandom. It started with a letter to each team. Now it's developing into something of a recruiting war, as a handful of teams have already responded with persuasive bids. From personalized letters to packages filled with gifts, the race for the free agent fan is in full force. The first to respond was the Pittsburgh Pirates team president, who wrote a letter filling in young Jack on Pirates history. That included a brief lesson on how the Pirates' nickname came to be. That made the Pirates the early leaders in the clubhouse, but then the New York Mets would enter the fray soon after, sending along a package filled with merchandise. Of course, Van Vliet's favorite team, the Astros, weren't going to sit idly by and allow a fan with Astros jeans to slip by. The team president of business operations got into the mix, signing a photo that can later be redeemed for tickets to any game. It appears Van Vliet's final decision is still a ways off. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Jennifer Kashinka. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.